I want to try to, in 1 Timothy 6, there's several passages that deal with money and riches. And I don't know why these passages are in the Bible, because really they never apply to any of us. I know people that are millionaires, and they say, well, we're not rich. Everyone thinks we're rich, but we're not rich. Got property, all over kind of things. And, I've had some students from India and Pakistan, and for them, everybody in the United States is just loaded, you know. So the way I look at that thing is, anyone thinks I'm rich, I reinforce it. I say, you bet I am. I really am. So you really don't even know. I won't even tell you. So, but I'm going to try to work through these passages and give you some principles on the general teaching, things you probably already know, but just we'll just reinforce it. We left off at verse 10, and actually, this verse is in the context that is warning Timothy, a person who was involved, terminology I've used is a vocational Christian service. In other words, he earns his living from ministering spiritual things. And the warnings directly apply to people in that category. However, since there is no distinction in the body of Christ in terms of mental attitude, the scripture rightly applies to all believers. Okay, within the context of this warning to Timothy about some of the dangers for money lovers, we have a statement in verse 10. For the love of money is not a thee, you should strike out the thee in your King James. It's in no texts have the article. This literally says this: for out of all the evils, plural, both plurals. Well, I didn't notice that before. That's what it says? That's what it says. Yeah. Out of all the evils, plural, is the philargia, the love of money. Okay? This desire for money. Now, really, I don't have a desire for sin. If you don't, why, then you've got problems, some other problems. Particularly in man, the desire enough money to properly support his family. If he doesn't have the motivation to get out and get some, he's got problems the other way. But this word love of money is the word philargia. Let's see, this is the feminine. Philargia. Two words here, philos, which means love, and which means passionate love, and agia, which means gold. So the word really means this, this strong passion for gold or money. Now it says this equals a root. Not a fruit, but a root. A root of all evils. So the idea is that the tap root for many evils is this, you know, and this is supposed to be a tap root. You know, on plants there are all kind of roots that go out. But there's one more main tap root. And going on this tree, whose taproot is philargia, are all kind of evils out here, see? Here's the fruit. And that could be fraud, which is a form of deceit, material lust, all kind of mental attitude sins, wars, murders. The Haifa incident is a good example of this. I don't think there's any question that the Teamsters Union is, particularly in certain areas, is largely controlled by the Mafia. And Haifa has always been one who, he was a knucklebuster, street fighter. And so he wouldn't back up, but he would go on a little bit, see. But the man who replaced him cooperated too freely with the Mafia. So the Haifa trying to take over again looks like Mafia's taking care of him. He's probably in the bottom of Lake Michigan in a trunk. And that thing is all the money and power. So the apostle is telling us that this love of money produces a fruit. So that people who are in pursuit of money, if they hook into that taproot pretty strongly, they can look for a lot of other evils to come into their life. Mental attitude sins. Pride. You see this kind of thing? Envy. The most envious people that I have ever seen, well, I haven't known personally, the most envious people were not poor people, but rich people who envy what other rich people had or didn't have or seemed to have. So I'm saying this love of money is a root of all evils. Okay? Okay. Now this brought with it some other aspects. Which now apparently refers to the love of money, which while some coveted after. Okay? Now that some coveted is a little worse. It's a participle. And it's a participle that's a verbal position. Which some, because coveting after. Because coveting after. For themselves. This for themselves is the idea of the middle voice. Okay, what you have here is only one word. This one word is a participle. And a participle is a word by nominally. Well, it's actually, O-R-E-G-O-N-E-N-O-I. This is an adverbial participle of cause, and it's in the present. It's a present, middle, adverbial participle of cause. Okay? Now, this word, really means, comes from the word, Lego, I guess, would have to be the source. Lego. This means to reach out or to stretch out. To reach out or stretch out. And the idea is that this, the person involved here, became involved with his passionate desire to have money, and then he stretched himself out together. He just stretched himself in all angles and in all ways in order to get the gold that he wanted. And because of that, you see, he did this with intensive interest of the results of the action. This is the middle voice. In other words, in his value system, this person figured that money could bring him what would really give him true meaning in life. And so he stretches himself out until there's a thing you can almost see through him. Okay, and the purpose of that is for money. Which, because certain have encountered, they have all from the faith. Now, text, the rich is really the subject of the word. Rich, because certain have coveted, they erred or they went astray from the faith. And it's a passive, it's a worse passive. There were astride is the idea. Which son, because, well, that doesn't seem to make sense. Which, you see, you take the son and then leave it down. Certain ones. Son, which, because coveting after for themselves, son, were astride. I don't know if astride is a word, but this gets the nearest passive, see? It's the nearest passive verb. From the faith. And the word faith here has an article with it, and this means the doctrine of Christianity with its values. Astray from that. There were influences in their life that took them astray from that. Nothing is in the world is worth that. Nothing. Power, influence, prestige, the security that man can bring, whatever type of security that is, that is temporary. Nothing is worth it. Now, what does that sound like from the Gospels? What does that sound like from the Gospels? Here in the value system, they were coveting after riches, for themselves, tens of interest in the results that the riches would bring. And because that was true, they were astrayed. What does that sound like in the Gospels? Anybody remember? What story? What verse? You cannot. No? You cannot serve God and mammon. You cannot serve God and mammon. You can't serve two masters. How's the idea that they became so involved in this that they were serving money? Then what is the proper order? Proper order is money serves you. And so that. They began to serve it, and because they did that, they went astray from the faith, which means they were believers. You see? In other words, these son here are believers, so don't try to, confuse the issue and make it somebody else. They were already in the faith, but they went astray from it. Now, that was not the only thing that happened. There was another thing that happened with it. There's another verb here. There's two verbs here. It's this verb, were astrayed, and then there's a last, and pierced. Some were astrayed, and they pierced. Did I write the following this down? Yes. Okay. And they pierced. Injuries have themselves. I didn't look at that. Let me look at that for just a second. Yes, themselves. And they pierce themselves through. Now this time you have an intensive, reflexive, not an intensive, but this is a reflexive pronoun. Okay? This is what we called last week. This is the harakiri of the soul. They did this. They didn't do this maybe intentionally, but this is one of the results of this. They pierced themselves through. The word pierced here, again, is an last active indicative. It's a fact. Okay? This calls attention to the fact of the action. This calls attention to the fact that they did this themselves, hence they were practicing self-induced misery, and this is the note of reality. Okay. Self-annihilation. They pierced themselves through, King James says, with many sorrows. That means soul misery. specifically what these soul miseries were not told, but probably included disillusionment, fear, anxiety, unrest. The soul misery follows the lifestyle of money lovers. Particularly believers who are caught up in this. Now that's interesting because when you do not have money, we think that money could solve most of the problems that we have. Now, that's probably not a one of us that doesn't think that way. If I only had X number of dollars right now, that would solve my problems. Well, maybe it would solve a few, but if you got involved with the love of that, instead of solving the problems of the soul, it would create the problems of the soul. These are soul miseries that Paul's talking about here. Anxiety over the money. How are you going to protect it? Think of the people who have lots of money now. Well, you always have to think somebody else because none of us ever have any. But everybody's worried about whether where would you invest your money now if you invested it wisely? Do you put it in gold? Well, it looks like the Rockefellers are trying to see to it that gold prices are held down. And they have almost the capacity to do it. Do you put it in stock? Don't look too good in stock. Put in a savings account. Not too good because it looks like there's going to be a revolution in this country. The first thing that goes are the savings and loans. And when they go out, your money goes. Do you keep it laying around the house fresh? No, inflation eats it up. Terrible predicament to have lots of money right now. I'll take all I have and try to hit it for anxiety and rest. That's not to say that, this is not to say that we're not to be good stewards and not to be concerned how we handle the money we have. That's just indicative that when a person gets caught up into this syndrome of the love of money, other problems are going to come. It's sort of a Trojan horse. Timothy is told in verse 11 and 12, I don't want to deal with these verses, I'm going to deal with them next week. Timothy is told, but thou, O man of God, flee these things, follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness, and fight the good fight of faith. Three commands are flee, follow, and fight. And all three of those are going to necessitate that you have a certain attitude toward these things, and that's the point of the whole passage. I like to go to that parable that Jesus uses this. He uses this word, philargyria, in a parable. And that parable is found in Luke 16 or 17. And then we'll come back and finish this chapter. I think this parable is misunderstood. Or could be misunderstood. Okay? The unjust steward, Luke 16. Now, what a parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. And when a parable is given, it's often important to understand who is listening to the parable because sometimes it's the key to the interpretation. And some of the people who were listening to the parable of the unjust steward in Luke 16 were money lovers. And they are mentioned in Luke 16:14. And the Pharisees also, who were covetous. See that word covetous? That is the word philargyroi. It is the masculine noun of this word. Covetous. Okay. Don't know how to help you with this, so I just write a few things. Parable of the crooked steward. This guy was so crooked when he died, they screwed him in the grave. Luke 16. In verse 14, the word covetousness is the word philargyroi. Okay? And the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things, and they derided and they scoffed him. That word derided means they sneered their lip and turned up their nose to him. And the reason they did was because of their covetousness. Okay? Now if you go back to the previous chapter, in the 15th chapter and the first verse, it says, then they drew nigh unto him all the publicans and sinners for the hearing. The publicans were crooks, the tax collectors. They were Jews who had turned coat to the Romans. So they were a tax collector crook. A Pharisee was a crook also. Well, he's a religious crook. He steals in the name of God. Remind me of that good advice that the judge in India gave Maharaji Ji. There's a big battle as to who was going to be the incarnation of God on earth. Was it Maharaji Ji, who was 17, or was it his brother, 25? Well, the person who was saying, making the determination, was their mother. She's getting into the act. Because Maharaji Ji's, his lifestyle in the United States has been just a little too fast. Taking all these expensive gifts that they're getting. So he went back to India to try to sell it, and it turned up in a court case. And the judge was lecturing him on selfishness. So he said to them, which is the greatest sin? So the other brother says, well, I guess it's selfishness. He sort of went along with the judge. And the Maharaji Ji from Denver says, the greatest sin is not to acknowledge God, who is our creator. And the judge says, you're both wrong. The greatest sin is to rob the poor in the name of God. Pretty good. Religious crooks. That's what the Pharisees were. They were religious crooks. They had a deal done where people had to bring sacrifices to the temple. And so they decided to corner the market on the sacrifice. So whenever a Jew wanted to buy a sacrifice, he generally bought it through an outlet that the Pharisees controlled. If he brought money to the temple to buy the sacrifice, then he had to have the money changed into the temple money. So when they changed the money, the normal coinage, into the temple money, then he got looked there. Then when he went to buy the sacrifice, he got looked there. And they did this all in the name of God. So there is, in verse 16, or chapter 16, verse 1, there's a third group. The sinners, that's us. They heard, the sinners heard this too. Third group is chapter 16, verse 1. He said also to his disciples. In other words, he directs the parable to his disciples, but overhearing it are the tax collectors, sinners, and the Pharisees. So there's going to be something in this probably for all of them, although it's directed toward the disciples. Okay? The earthly story comes in verses 1 through 8. And he said also unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward, a household manager. And the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. And he called him and he said unto him, what's happening? How is it that I hear of this of you? Let's get the books open and get the CPAs in and we'll get an account of your stewardship. For you're done being a steward. You're through. Thou must be no longer steward. So the steward says, okay, we're going to have an accounting. Boy, how am I going to handle this? He said within himself, verse 3, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig, and I am ashamed to beg. In other words, I don't want to work. I don't want to dig a ditch. I don't want to be a laborer. And I don't want to beg. If he said he would have wanted to beg, he would have been a hero, but that part of him sort of eliminates it. I am resolved what to do. I'll go on your life. I am resolved what to do. When I am put out of the stewardship, that they may receive me into their houses. In other words, he thinks up a scheme, motivated by self-preservation and the desire not to work. However, he can maybe make some friends with people, but when he loses his job, that these people will help him. Okay? So, verse 5, he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him. Now he's really going to juggle the books. Says unto the first, how much do you owe my Lord? And he says, 100 measures of oil. That's about 900 gallons, according to the dictionaries that I looked up. And he says, I'll tell you what, take your bill, sit down quickly, and we'll sell for 50. In other words, I'll take just half. So he cuts that guy's bill in half. Then said he to another, how much do you owe, my Lord? And he says, 100 measures of wheat. That's about 1,000 to 1,100 bushels, according to the dictionary I looked up. He says, take thy bill and write for a score. In other words, he cuts his... he's probably doing this on the basis of strictly what these people, he feels these people can handle. And this one he only knocks 20% off. Previously he knocked 50% off. And it appears that these people could hear that. And remember his motivation though. His motivation was that by doing this he's making friends with these people so that when he loses his job, well, he'll have some place to go. Okay. Verse 8. And the Lord, notice this is in the small letters, which is proper. This Lord in verse 8 is the steward's Lord. And the steward's Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Now, what is that last part? For the children of this world, was it the Lord of the steward that said that? Or was it Aaron that said that? There was an addendum by Luke. Luke making a divine judgment of what had happened. Well, it has to be some type of a summation of what had happened. For the children of this world in their generation are wiser than the children of light. What does that mean? It means that the children of the world, the unsaved people, pursue their own motivation with more diligence, particularly in terms of money matters, than do the children of light. Okay? The entire basis of their thinking is bounded by the age in which they live, by their generation, in their generation. They prosecute their schemes with more ingenuity, more singleness of aim, more earnestness, greater perseverance than do the children of light. And in that sense, they're wiser than the children of light. It isn't a justification of what this man does. It simply means that they are more singularly motivated in their generation than are the children of light. Okay? Now in verse 9, you begin to have the application of this. And I say unto you, this is our Lord speaking now, and he's speaking to his disciples, no make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. And the mammon here, of course, stands for money. And when he calls it the mammon of unrighteousness, he doesn't mean that, he's not talking about filthy lucre. He's not talking about filthy lucre here. This word unrighteousness is arakia, which means that it has no righteousness. This would be better translated non-righteousness. Okay? In other words, it is unmoral. It is not unmoral. It is not unmoral, it is amoral. There is no righteousness or unrighteousness in matter. Evil does not reside in matter. You see? Money is simply just a means of exchange, and it has no evilness within itself. So he's saying, make of yourselves friends of the money that is amoral or has no inherent righteousness. In a critical text, the next statement is just a little different. When you fall, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Now, what would that mean? When you fall, what would be everlasting habitations? Well, there's some type of identification in eternity with these people. That's what it has to be everlasting. In other words, be non-temporal. Well, then when you fall, that would be what? If you assume that everlasting habitations is something relative to eternity, when you fall, what would that be? Huh? Death. That would be death. Yeah, right. Okay? The critical text translates it, when it falls. When it falls, it would be then the money that he would be talking about. And then, that's a little hard to explain what the everlasting habitations would be. It would be something that would be more secure than a temporal habitation. Maybe the concept of eternal friendship or so on. Okay? Well, what is the exit, what is the essence statement. The essence of verse 9, which is the application of the first application of the parable, the essence of that is that we are to wisely and eagerly use our money for human good. Some extension of the money on the horizontal level for the good. Okay? It's a principle. Let me show it to you, okay? Look at Ephesians chapter. Keep your hand here. Okay? Well, it's for the good of humans. God of mankind. I'm not talking about the effort of the believer to produce human good. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that the proper stewardship of money means, or should be equal to, on this level, or should be similar in the event of production of good for mankind. That's a principle. Now watch. Look at Ephesians. Is Ephesians on it? I think it is. I think it's verse 28. Stop stealing. He's telling him, stop stealing. Let this person labor, working with his hands, the thing which is good. Now he may satisfy his own needs. Is that what it says? No, it says that he may have to give to him that need it. You see? One of the motivations in that person's life should be not just meeting his own needs and the needs of his family, but being able to help others. An extension on the human level. Go to 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6. Verses 17 and 18, you always have this concept of extension in stewardship. 1 Timothy 6, 17 and 18. Charge them that are rich in this world, this age, that they be a real man and they trust in certain riches, that in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. And that concept is the communication on whatever level of the riches that God gave them. See what I'm saying? Okay. Same concept you have in 1 John, what is it, 4? I forget the verse. 4:17. 1 John 4:17. It says, if we continually say a brother is continually having a need for the things that abide us, the essential things of life, and we say to that brother, Lord bless you, I'll see you, may God on our way help you out with the love of God. And yes, concept is we have, and maybe they can help. Well, that's what Jesus is saying, I think, in chapter 16, verse 9. We have to wisely, even if we have our money, not just to meet our own needs, but with the concept that we can help others with it. Now, verse 10 has no application in verse 10 of the parable. In verse 10 through 12, he's encouraging the divine viewpoint. Verses 10 through 12, which is another application. Jesus encourages divine viewpoint evaluation. Jesus encourages divine viewpoint evaluation of man and all that man can bring. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful in much. The least is to get the, let's say, lesser least, right? Is that correct? Less, lesser, least? Less, more, less, least. Leastest. He is faithful in that which is leastest. Is faithful in that which is also much. He that is unjust in the leastest is unjust also in much. But what would be the leastest in the context? What's the leastest? One. Right. There's ten. The leastest has to equal, from the divine viewpoint, the minimum. If you're not in an attitude that you'd be faithful in that which is least from the divine viewpoint, how are you going to be faithful in much? Now this is reinforced. If therefore, verse 11, you have not been faithful in the unrighteous manner, see, there's the application. There's the proof that verse 10 is talking about mammon as the least. Now, the idea of being faithful in the least, faithful in this, which is the leastest, is the idea of proper stewardship. Which means, money serves you, not you it. Money serves you, not vice versa. If you get to the place where you serve the money, then you've transcended that line of proper faithfulness. And for money to serve you, it has to have some type of concept of generosity, particularly in relationship to believers. If thou hast not been faithful, if therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, the mammon has the riches, who will command you to trust the true riches? Okay, that which is true, what would that be? What would the true riches be? Anybody want to guess? Added values, yeah, I guess.
True riches,
then in verse 11, would have to be that which is more valuable from divine viewpoint. So whatever you want to make it, you take it on the human level, you would take like life and love. If you can't be faithful in some little thing, how's somebody going to give you something that's very friendship? You see, those kind of important honesty on the human level, that which is of real value in life. If you can't be faithful in a simple little thing like money, who wants to commit this other to you, you see? So true riches here from, you take that now and apply it to the spiritual realm, and this would be that which has more value from the divine viewpoint. And money from the divine viewpoint would be the leastest. Verse 12 reinforces this. It's just another way of saying, if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who shall give you that which is your own, that which rightfully belongs to you? Now here again is that concept of faithful stewardship. And in verse 13 you have the climax, the final dramatic point of the whole parable. Now servant. No slave can serve two masters, serving a slave. For either he will hate the one, hate the other, or else he will have the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And mammon here is personified as a god. Marriage, the final principle in verse 13 is the idea that you have to have your priorities straight before other things will straighten themselves out in terms of money. God matters primarily to serve Him. Money is one God, just one of many, that can interfere. The challenge to the disciple is that he must get his priorities straight in this. God did not make us to traffic in merchandise or to improve the culture or for other things. He made us to serve him. Okay, now that's kind of the same thing that Paul is saying. He's saying this inordinate desire, this inordinate love, this philandera, is going to bring with it a lot of heartache. Okay, so Timothy is to flee from that. Any questions on the parable, or on what we're saying? I have several points that I want to give you. I'd like to go back to Timothy though and see if I can let's go back to Timothy and just look at the passage on the witch, and we'll go through some of the details. This is a beautiful grammatical passage, and I don't want to hurl it. Spend too much time with the grammar, so I'm not going to just rush over it. It's in verse 17 and 18, what you have is a command to Timothy, and out of that command you have five infinitives, which are indirect commands, okay? I charge you, verse 17. Here's the grammar of this passage. I charge you, and this word charge means to command. The name is Timothy. Well, is Paul, and this is the sense of command. So the command goes to Timothy, and from Timothy out to the witch, in the form of five infinitives. So these are all indirect commands, all infinitives. Okay? And we're going to look at those next time, but I want you to get the gist of this, because I want to give you some points on the general teaching of Bible in a minute. I charge them by which in this age, Timothy number one, that they be not high-minded, in Timothy number two, that they trust, that they do not trust in uncertain riches, but in living God, I can understand, who give us richly all things to enjoy. The word rich is plutos. The word richly is plutos. In other words, you take that same word, you put it in a certain case, and it becomes an adverb. So there's a play on words here. The plutos are the rich. And the plutos is God gives richly. Why did he give richly? He gave richly to enjoy the things. So if you're rich, like me, enjoy it. I mean, you don't go around a guilt complex, you know. How many times have you ever had a man that, Dad, I think I'll serve the Lord, I'm going to sell my house, and give all the money to the church. Well, for those of us who desire to be rich, that sounds like a pretty good idea. Yeah, that is if you're in my position. Totally false. Asceticism is a lie. It's a lie. It's a deceiver. The vows of the venerable monk and those who still take them of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Last two aren't too bad. Their sin nature, all three of those stimulate their sin nature. And of course, the concept was that they did this in order to be more approved of God.
St. Francis of Assisi, who's the great hero now, that environmentalist, because Francis, who was a very wealthy Frenchman? Assisi? Spanish? Yeah. French or Spanish? I can't remember.
Turned his back on his inheritance and took all his money and gave it all away and put on a sackcloth and went out and talked to the birds and so on. You see pictures of Francis talking to the birds and holding his hand up and the bird comes and lights on his hand and all that. He's a great hero today. That's false. It's a false concept of spirituality. He ignored this verse. God gave richly to enjoy it. Don't forget about it. And then the infinitive. Let they do good. Here's the extension now. Let they be rich. Another use of the word plutois. In good works. In the production of divine good. Ready to distribute, which means they're not grasping. They're not hoarding. Willing to communicate. No reference to the frame of mind of these people. And no attitude in terms of the fact that they're stewards. And they're very willing to communicate what God had given them.
See?
Well, that's going to help us because I think we've laid enough groundwork
to mention something about the general teaching of Scripture on riches,
okay?
I put down six, there's a lot more you could say. But there is so much to say about money. There are six points. Six points on the general biblical teaching.
It has to be protected. a biblical viewpoint. In other words, any system that does not protect the right of private property is anti-biblical. Okay? This is found both in the New Testament. Okay? The concept, for instance, of in the commandments, Exodus 20, verse 15 and 17. The right commandment, thou shalt not steal. The idea of stealing means you take that which is not your own, but which is belonging to somebody else. That's private property. The 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ox, nor his ass, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. No, it belongs to him. It's his. It's not yours. It's private property. These are repeated, of course, in the New Testament. A statement that we read in Ephesians 4, in verse 28, that a man is to work in one of our minds and help others. The concept is that God is a light of private property. Point 4. Man is made to serve God, not money. Man is made to serve God, not money. Is to serve man. Now, everywhere Scripture encourages wise stewardship. Sometimes you may not make a profit. You may just amortize something. It may just carry its own. But maybe it would do such good that you ought to take that route. Now, I say that because of a background. I was in a school situation where I had a good business manager. He had a business background which I do not have. I know nothing about business. So when I want some advice about business, I talk to somebody who knows something about it. And in this school situation, we had an agreement that I would have a certain role and my business manager would have a certain other role. And I wouldn't spend a dime without his permission. I just wouldn't do it. It was a principle that we set up. And one of the first things that I suggested in this school situation, that is that we quit paying to the high school kid. And we started paying to married couples in this school because those people know what the Lord wants them to do. When they come here, they know what they want to do. And that's the purpose of the school. We want to train people who know what they want to do. They don't come here to find out. They come here supposed to know so that we can give them some personal training. Let's start building buildings for these people. The suggestion was rejected on a business basis. And what is the business basis? We can't make money on those buildings. They will only amortize themselves. Well, we're not in the business to make money. It would have done good. That's good enough. And it would have amortized themselves. We would not have lost money on it. See what I'm saying? To me, good stewardship in that case would have been appealing to this type of student. To my business manager, it was not. You wanted to make a little bit. And on a single student in a dormitory situation, you put enough in and you make some money on it. The boy opted to go on his route. Well, of course, in every situation in life, anybody that has to determine before the Lord what is wise stewardship in this matter. And how is exercised that way? There are many scriptures. He's encouraged. And this includes beneficial use of our money, particularly for other believers, see? Okay? Like in Luke 16, verses 9 through 13, use your money wisely. 2 Timothy 6, verses 17 and 18. First John 4:17. Divine viewpoint. Apart from the divine viewpoint of knowing, the believer will be hopelessly confused. Experiences in life. Hyphen, money matters. Well, so I'm going this route because I'm going to serve the Lord. He gets down the road so far and says, boy, I wish I knew going that route. Sheesh. What did I do before I could have made a bomb ball, but I've done this, I've done that, I should have done this, should have done that. So when you get a chance, if you really see this, read Psalm 73. Just absolutely tremendous. Psalm Asaph. He begins to look around and says, looking prospering and stacking up ball out of all, and he said, a mistake. And then finally he goes into the Old Testament, and of course he goes into the temple and he identifies with God, and then this, the whole thing gets straightened out in his mind. Point six, a point I'd like to make, I'm sure you can add to these many, many other scriptures and many other principles, but I want you to be sure he doesn't. The cynicism is around. So this is going to be a lie. Two other things. Money. Giving. By God. For believers to enjoy. No virtue in poverty. There's no virtue in poverty. First Timothy 6:17. Okay. Next week we're going to take up the intermediary verses. Verse 11 through probably 16. Are there any questions about what I've raised? You can answer, or I can answer. Spirit will be able to analyze this truth in each life of each believer that's here in terms of personal application and in the privacy of their own lives, in Jesus' name.